we waited 2 years, it's going to explode. Nobody's going to be able to afford it. It's a disaster. We want to get something done and get it done right.
That's the big subject of the day. It's 109. We are live in the Allstate Michigan Avenue Showcase Studio. This is John Williams. Hi. Our Trump Talk comes at 2 o'clock on this show. We do not talk about things presidential or Washington until 2, but bank on it at 2, and we will be talking about the health care bill and where it is today. That'll come your way, oh, let's say in about an hour. John Williams in the studio. Dave Ennett is in the studio, too. Hi, Mr. Ennett. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
You're not good. Do you have a little bit of a cold?
I'm getting over it. I had the cold in Salt Lake City last week, but I fought through it, and thankfully it's breaking up now.
I'm sorry that you're not well. I really appreciate you giving me a little of your time as a result.
Anytime.
Well, there's a couple things that I just wanted to talk to you about. One was Dallas Green passed away, so now we've lost two sort of iconic, or maybe not iconic, but great names.
Oh, I think maybe iconic.
Iconic works for you. Well, I think, does Dallas Green rise to the level of people are like, wow, Dallas Green?
Well, I'm not so sure it had that reaction today. More time had passed since Dallas Green was part of the Chicago Cubs, but I think he deserves, he didn't win 6 championships like Jerry Krause's Bulls did, but he did what at the time seemed almost as remarkable, which was that he put together a team that won a division championship with the Cubs and was probably the best team in baseball that year, even though they ended up losing to the San Diego Padres in the NLCS.
Tell me about that. I remember that team. Who was on that team and what happened in San Diego? Is that the one where the ground ball went through somebody's
legs? Yes, that
legs?
Is the one. That's the one, John.
I seem to remember that.
A lot of people tried to delete that from their memory bank.
You know, but it's funny because you had the Bill Buckner booting the ball at first base. Mm-hmm. We had our own version of that, right?
Yes, and Bill Buckner was traded, if you remember that year, for Dennis Eckersley. But Dallas Green was the old school kind of wheeler dealer, didn't worry too much about hurting feelings.
Hated the happy loser sort of thing, wanted to get away from that.
Right. He came in as the slogan or the motto for marketing purposes was building a new tradition.
Yeah.
And they put that on the tops of the dugouts, I believe, at Wrigley Field. And, yeah, they wanted to shake the whole lovable losers thing, which ultimately the Cubs did, but it took a few more years. But that year was, I think, if you were, say, in your 20s, 30s, or even a kid back then, I think that was just a magical summer in Chicago. It was on that team because, remember, they hadn't done much up until then. And he made these deals, and he acquired Gary Matthews, and he had brought Ryan Sandberg to the Cubs a year or so earlier. You had all these guys sort of developing. You had guys acquired via trade. You had the deal for Sarge. They had brought Keith Moreland in.
Yeah, he had this Ron Philadelphia Say. Crew that he liked.
Yeah, and then the big deal to get Rick Sutcliffe, who ended up winning the Cy Young Award that year in the National League, and he was the 1984 version of 2015 Jake Arrieta.
Yeah. He went at 1.16-1, mm-hmm. I was reading today.
Yep.
I thought, I remembered he was good. I didn't remember he was that good.
He was pretty much unbeatable.
Yeah. So Dallas Green was kind of the engineer or the architect of all of that.
He was. He was the general manager back when that was the title.
But then what happened
afterwards? Then he became president.
Yeah.
He had a falling out with the Tribune Company management and ended up holding a news conference at which he said, well, in this business, you either resign or you get fired, and I'm getting fired. I'm resigning. And
then
he walked away from the podium.
Really?
That was it. Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Because a lot of people, they say, listen, here's the deal. We're going to let you quit. If you don't, you're fired. I call that you got quit fired. You are no longer going to work here. You can quit, but you're getting quit. You're getting quit fired.
Wait a minute. Here is the actual sound of that day.
Do I need to have something?
Do you have the, let's see, it says ENPS.
Standby. Am I going in the right direction here?
Probably should have given, no, it's to the left side. Here, to the left side. I should have given you a little warning.
No, that's okay. That's all right. Here we go. Okay,
there
hit it.
Okay, here it is. This was
you have this
1987.
Handy. I've been in baseball 30 years, 30-some now, and I know that when philosophical differences pop up, as they will from time to time between ownership and field people, there's only a couple routes to go. One, you get fired, or one, you resign.
It's the same direction either way.
And he said, I'm resigning, thank you, and he walked away.
Have a good night, everybody.
That was it.
He brought the lights to Wrigley Field.
Lights to Wrigley Field, fought that battle. You know, there was a point in 1984 when the Cubs were winning. They were talking about moving the Cubs' home games to St. Louis or to Comiskey Park because the Cubs wouldn't be able to play night games at Wrigley. And, of course, ultimately in 1988, they installed the lights. He was gone about a year when that actually took place. But he put together a coaching staff with Jim Frey that included Don Zimmer, his third base coach. So you had two managers, two tremendous managers. I mean, Jim Frey won a division championship here, and of course he'd won in Kansas City. And Don Zimmer won a division championship in 1989 with players, most of whom had been acquired by the Dallas Green regime.
Hmm. I saw in Fortune magazine, did you guys talk about this morning
too? Yes, we did a little bit.
Okay, so just speaking of Cubs management, I don't exactly understand what they're doing here, but Fortune magazine has their list of the top 50 greatest leaders in the world. The top 50 greatest leaders in the world.
Yes.
In the world.
In the world. Fortune magazine, pretty respectable
publication. I know. Now,
right?
It should probably tell me that this isn't your normal leader list. Angela Merkel is on there. John McCain is on there. But Chance the Rapper is on there, too.
But he's way down the list. He's 46.
And Chance is, like, awesome. I mean, I think he's on message. His music is great. Uh-huh. He's making good decisions. Loving the Chance.
Did you mention the Pope?
The Pope is number three.
Number three
on the list.
Jeff Bezos is what, number five?
He's number five.
Yeah,
number five.
the head and president and CEO of Amazon is at number five. Yeah.
But who's number one, dude?
Number one is Theo Epstein, your president of business of baseball operations for the Chicago Cubs.
And maybe that's not so absurd. If you can take something that is historically, chronically poorly managed, or you know, I don't know what the end of that is, historically, chronically something, bad stuff's happened, and you win a World Series, that's a good thing.
I'll tell you why it makes sense. Number one, I think Theo Epstein has a world view that goes beyond baseball. He's involved in a lot of charitable causes, always has been, and has been kind of not shy about spreading the word about causes he believes in.
Yeah.
I've seen him speak. I've had the pleasure of emceeing a corporate outing where he was speaking to business leaders, and he really, I think, is a compelling in that setting. That he had every ear, he had every eye on him, and I think he stayed very much on message to business people. So I do think that.
Oh, it wasn't just baseball. It wasn't just baseball.
No, and he was explaining the business of baseball, but I think that he kind of gets it, and I think he's somebody that anyone running a corporation would probably look up to and say, okay, this guy figured it out.
Yeah, no kidding.
And he's done it twice.
Right, and if you can do that for your company, maybe what you did there will translate to what I need to do here.
And he's done it with two places where supposedly it couldn't get done.
Really, if you did it at one of those, they would say, wow.
Right.
You can retire on that. He did it twice at two of the hardest companies, if you will, or at least the most snake-bit companies to get that done.
Right.
What have you got, Ryan?
We've got Kyle Hendricks talking about that today, saying that, Theo is a drought ender.
I think I haven't seen anybody else end a drought like he has, especially two places. So I think it's definitely special. I hadn't seen that yet. That's pretty cool. Really cool for him.
And Chris Bryant was asked about what he thinks about him beating out even the Pope.
I think we got a lot of Cubs fans all over the world now, so I guess they voted him out.
Yeah, I heard the Pope is ticked. I heard the Pope is.
I think the Pope's okay with it because it's Theo. And here's the other thing.
Pope still thinks he's in Boston. You know, it's a very Catholic town.
Yes. Kyle Hendricks is an Ivy League guy. You know, Kyle Hendricks probably reads Fortune magazine.
He says, yes, I saw it when I was reading it online today.
Yeah.
So here's what Fortune says. In the fall of 2016, as partisan distrust and division reached abysmal depths, fascination with the Chicago Cubs became that all-too-rare phenomenon that united America. And I remember that. I remember tweeting something out like, you know, thank you, Chicago, or thank you, Cubs. We needed that. And it was on behalf of all humanity. Boy, was that the right team. In fact, if we could get the Cubs to play right now... I know they are.
Well,
in Arizona,
they are going to very soon.
If they could just swing by, if they could just stroll through Congress, I don't know, just start popping up at places, it would make all of us feel good again. In fact, speaking of that, so did you watch Dancing with the Stars?
I don't normally watch Dancing with the Stars, but I was watching it the other night.
Why?
Because my wife was. But it also turned out that David Ross was on.
Okay, so David Ross, you know, as much as we loved him, his last at bat is the way to go out, isn't it?
No question.
Hit a home run in the last game of the World Series in your last at bat. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember how important that was. That wasn't the...
It wasn't in the 10th inning rally, but how they needed
every run.
Every
run counts.
If he doesn't hit that home run, they don't get to 10 innings, perhaps.
I thought it was really nice what they did with him in setting up his ability to dance. And then you saw him dance, right?
I did.
He was not that bad.
I think that I don't have a lot to base it on, but I'm pretty sure it would be better than my dancing.
Yeah. You know, I do a little ballroom dancing.
I know you do, John.
I do ballroom dancing and have for quite a few years now. I've spent thousands of dollars on ballroom dancing lessons.
Have you really?
I can't dance ballroom at all. I'm terrible at it.
So what do those guys get, like a week?
That's the thing.
In the gym or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's very intense and it's very focused, and they got the best coaches and teachers in the world, but I was impressed with what he was able to do. My problem, thanks for asking, is that I have no sense of musical timing or rhythm, so that they go, well, just do it to the music, and I'm like, oh, that's easy for you to say. I can't follow the music that well. Snapping your fingers to a song? I can't do that for a minute. I'll then be off pace. I'll have to sort of reconnoiter and then start all over again.
And that throws off the band.
Oh, it throws off my wife because we're trying to dance here. And it doesn't always go well.
Well, I was impressed by him. I mean, and it's live, too. Now, he's used to performing live. Most of those games are live. They're not taped.
Yeah, right.
But still, to get out there on national TV on what always looks to me like a slippery floor and not, not fall.
Well, there is supposed to be a little glide to it.
Yeah.
Well, nice to see you. Thanks for coming in the studio. I'll let you, I'm going to play the Dancing with Stars audio after the commercial break, but since you've already seen it and you're a little under the weather, you don't have to stick around, although you're more than welcome to, Dave Bennett, if you'd like.
Well, I think you are much better prepared to, I think, analyze the steps since you are a ballroom dancer yourself.
We'll listen to you tomorrow morning with Steve Cochran. Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
It's Dave Bennett. It's 121. This is WGN.
I'm at Wrigley Field. I'm just excited to be here. Hi!
Hello, how are you? My name is David Ross, former Major League Baseball player, current World Series champion, Chicago Cubs.
So you just retired.
I just retired. My last official at-bat was a home run, Game 7 of the World Series.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I would have had a victory dance after the World Series, but my teammates carried me off the field. I am the first Major League Baseball player to be on this show.
That is pretty insane.
It's a lot of pressure. There's some good dancers out there in Major League Baseball.
Are there?
Yeah.
Well,
and
you're
I'm
gonna
not
show
one
them.
Of them. I think what was going through Lindsay's mind is, who is this old guy I got to dance with?
Well, we were all wondering that when he was first signed with the Cubs. And what a nice tribute to him. His family looks delightful. He seemed to be in a really good place. It's a wonderful story for him to be able to tell. Then they cut away to a video or a live video feed, and some of his teammates were there giving him grief. It was a fun send-up. I hope he goes far in that show. Just back to Fortune magazine for a second, as they were saying that Theo Epstein, I don't know who assigned this thing at Fortune, but I'm not sure that this is one of their top editors. But Theo Epstein, I get it. It's good. It's all good. As the Cubs fought to end a 108-year championship drought, television ratings for the World Series soared by almost 50%. Even casual fans who did not know a bunt from a beanball stayed up late to watch the excruciating extra inning Game 7 that turned baseball's most famous lovable losers into winners at last. The Cubs owe their success to a five-year rebuilding program that featured a concatenation. That's a concatenation of different leadership styles. The team thrived under the affable patience of owner Tom Ricketts and later under the innovative eccentricity of manager Joe Maddon. But most important of all was the evolution of the Cubs' president for baseball operations, Theo Epstein, the wunderkind executive who realized that he would need to grow as a leader in order to replicate in Chicago the success that he had with the Boston Red Sox. In his book, The Cubs Way, Sports Illustrated senior baseball writer Tom Verducci described that evolution, showing how a deeper understanding of important human qualities among his players, the character, the discipline, and the chemistry that turned skilled athletes into leaders, enabled Epstein to engineer one of the most remarkable turnarounds in sports. Yeah, it's kind of nice.
And he's 43 years old.
Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it? 43. I suppose the real proof of his management style and genius will be if we, you know, aren't just one and done. I'm sorry, White Sox, but you guys did not have a great year after you won the World Series. It'd be nice to see the Cubs win it again, or at least go deep in the playoffs, and then be there, you know, 2, 3, 4 years from now still. And with the team they've got on the field, you could see how that could happen, that's for sure.
Very doable.
Yeah. It's 129. The news is doable. Next on GN. DNA Info did the story. The guy who's in love with Portillo's lemon cake finally got a slice. Portillo's lemon cake finally got a slice. The man who spent a decade searching for Portillo's lemon cake has his cake and he's eaten it too. His name is Ben. He grew up in West Lawn. He grew up eating desserts. He loved the lemon cake dessert at Portillo's. But about a decade ago, Portillo stopped serving the cake. He said lemon is a very tough flavor to get right. He said you can go to a lot of places and they'll have chocolate this, chocolate that. But lemon is tough. A lot of people just don't go there. And when they do, they don't do it right. He posted to Reddit in late February and he said, I offer $300 as a bounty for the cake's recipe or a dessert that tastes as good. In fact, he said, I'll give you $30 extra if you can give me the recipe. So $300 to approximate it and 30 more. I don't know why he chose 330, but there's the number. 30 more if you can give me the recipe itself. And it goes viral. Again, he initially posted it on Reddit. And then Portillo's saw this. And there are no dummies over there. Oh, I'm such a Portillo's fan. People say, John, why'd you come back to Chicago? I say Portillo's. Promising to make Ben a cake at the location and time of his choice. So he and his cousin get on planes. They live in Arizona, or at least he does, and they fly to Chicago. And they went to the one where he first fell in love with Portillo's lemon cake, and they served him lemon cake. And now he's got an online petition asking for Portillo's to put the cake back on the menu. I love lemon stuff, too. Lemon cookies, lemon cupcakes, lemon cake. And I think he's right. It's hard to get it right. And I think he's right. You don't always see it. He's on line 8. Hey, Ben, this is John Williams. You're on WGN. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm doing very well. Very well. Thank you so much. How are you today?
I'm good. Everybody has a quest. Yours is a little different, yeah. My friend.
That is 100% true. This quest did not go anywhere near the way I thought it did. It exceeded my expectations by so much, I can't even tell you.
Well, I left out the part where you tasted the cake and then what happened. So you sit down, and they have a whole lemon cake, right?
That's absolutely right. The good people at Portillo's were kind enough to actually bake a fresh lemon cake for me and my family. And give us the whole thing, and they even gave us some Portillo's swag in the form of some T-shirts and some merchandise, and basically took it back. And my cousin and my family, we all sat down to have a nice Portillo's dessert, just like we remembered from almost 10 years ago.
Yeah, but you did eat it in Chicago first before you took it back to Arizona, right? You did have a slice there, right?
That's absolutely right. So I'd actually flown in specifically for this from Phoenix, where I currently live. My family's still living out in the southwest suburbs of Chicago. And we picked up the cake at one of the Portillo's there. And then we all got together at the original Portillo's, especially out in Crestwood, Illinois, where we had had the lemon cake. And it was just basically just like old times. We cut into that cake and once we had that first piece, all was right with the world. It tasted phenomenal, like I hadn't tasted in 10 years.
They put a picture of it online in DNA Info, and
yes,
it looks really good. It looks so moist, and it just, I don't know, you know, if a picture of a cake can look moist, it looks really awesome. And the icing is really thick. I like me a thick coating of icing. Is that kind of just a white icing, or is it like a tart lemony icing on that?
So it is in every way lives up to what that picture looks like. It is a very thick, rich, buttery, lemon-flavored icing.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it's generously put on there between the layers, on top of the layer cake, and that icing, as soon as you lift it up, that top lid of the cake container, you can just smell it walking over. We had a little crowd of people coming over trying to check out what was going on because it looked exactly like that chocolate cake, but it's lemon.
So then they give you the cake, off you go. Then you start this online petition to try and get them to put it back on the menu. Have you heard back from Portillo's?
You know, I haven't heard back anything definite, but, you know, that petition has got over 1,100 signatures, you know, last I checked, which was last night. And if you got some time, you should check the petition because the comments that people are putting up there are just inspiring. People sharing stories of what they remember about the cake, people whose parents or grandparents who maybe are no longer with us used to share this when they were little, and they're just longing for a taste to remind them. There was one gentleman who was actually living in Spain who was backpacking through the U.S. like 10 years ago, happened to stop at a Portillo's, had this lemon cake, and has been thinking about it and searching for something like it, and came across the Reddit and the petition and find it. I mean, I've had people from Australia, from all over the United States, you know, message me saying how much they love the cake. They tried it once or twice and would love to see it back. I mean, it's just amazing.
I don't even remember it. I mean, I don't think I've ever had Portillo's lemon cake, and I've had their chocolate cake, and their, you know, I'm not even a big cake fan necessarily. That chocolate cake is the best chocolate cake in the world. If the lemon cake is as good at being lemon cake as the chocolate cake is being chocolate cake, now I got to have the lemon cake. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you're saying. I don't want to offend a lot of chocolate lovers out there. That chocolate cake is phenomenally good. But chocolate is so common.
Yep.
You can find a good chocolate, you know, almost anything, anywhere. Trying to find a good lemon flavored dessert has been so hard. I've been on this quest for almost 10 years. I outlined it in that Reddit post. I mean, either it's too tart or too sweet. The lemon's either overwhelming or just not enough there. And there was this right combination, this right balance that Portillo's just happened to get.
The Portillo's just happens
so
to get, yeah.
Delicious.
By the way, Derek wanted to jump in here. Hey, Derek, this is John. You're on WGN. Hi.
Hello, hello.
Hey, you're on the air. What's up?
I was calling to say that the understanding I have about the lemon cake is that they stopped making it because when they would keep it out on the counter for a presentation, the frosting would slide off of the outside of the cake and it wouldn't present well.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
They pulled it for that reason, and I'll tell you this too. I was a fan of the lemon cake shake instead of the chocolate cake shake. I went in once and I thought, you know, lemon sounds good instead of chocolate because, like, the chocolate's really heavy. So I got it once in the summer, and it is 10 times better than the chocolate cake shake.
Wow.
And you know how the chocolate cake shake is.
Derek, I'm so glad you called in. I agree 100%.
Well, Ben, they gave you the recipe, right? For $30, they gave you the recipe for the cake?
Yeah, they actually did. The Portillo's folks were so kind. They actually didn't want any money for it. They basically said, just take the money that you're going to pay for this and donate it to a charity. And they partner with the American Red Cross. So I true to my word, I donated $330 to the American Red Cross in Portillo's name. And actually, we got a couple of folks on Reddit who were touched by that level of generosity, and they'd actually donated a matching amount to another charity. So now we've generated some goodwill, more than just the cake.
And nice of you to call, Derek. Thanks for joining us.
Yep.
Yeah. Have a good day. Is the have you tried to duplicate it? Would you share with us the recipe, or does everybody have the recipe? What's going on there?
Right. No, not everybody has the recipe. Portillo's generosity was just unbelievable. They heard my plea. They were touched by my fond recollection of the cake and my quest for it. And they actually did share with me the recipe. I think it's something I can tackle at home. I personally am not a baker by profession, but I'm definitely going to give this one a shot.
But you're not going to post the recipe online, are you?
You know, I asked them specifically. I wanted to. I've gotten literally thousands of private messages on Reddit asking me to please share the recipe. So I asked Portillo's, you know, point blank. I'm like, can I put this up? There's such an outcry for it. Can you just, you know, let me put it up there?
Yeah.
And they said, no, we prefer that you don't share it. And it was for this reason, which is the best reason ever, which is that they're considering bringing back the lemon cake in stores because they've heard people's love for this cake. And I think that they want to bring it back on a trial basis, maybe a seasonal item and see how it does. And if it does okay, you know, fingers crossed, they might bring it back on a permanent basis. So that's why they want us to hold back the recipe. And, you know, I can't think of a better reason. If we could get this thing back in stores for everyone to enjoy, that would just be the icing on the cake right there.
The icing on the cake. All right, Ben. Well, congratulations. You know, I wish you a long life, but you probably won't accomplish anything as great as what you have achieved here, sir.
This may be the only thing I do in life that matters. It's unbelievable.
It's nice to talk to you. Thanks for visiting with us. And if, by the way, they do announce that, you know, to you or to anybody else that they're going to bring back the lemon cake, let me know. Okay, I'll meet you at a Portillo's.
I absolutely will. You know, that change.org petition I still have up, and I think the more signatures we can get up there, the more people will Portillo's will realize that people really want this thing back. And if you have a chance, you should, the change.org petition. If you have a chance, I put up a YouTube video of the cake being sliced. And if you think that picture looks good, you should see what it looks like when they slice that cake fresh from the bakery and then, you know, slice up and serve up a couple of pieces. Man, it's mouthwatering.
Nice to talk to you, my friend. Stay well. Stay warm in Arizona.
Thank you. You too. Have a good day, John.
There he goes. He's torturing me, man. I got to end this conversation. It's killing me. That and a hot cup of coffee would be a really beautiful thing. I know that when the chocolate cake, I guess this has been the case for a while, but people are always trying to duplicate the chocolate cake. And I think there are recipes out there that approximate their chocolate cake pretty convincingly. And I think you put pudding in there or motor oil or something. There's some sort of obvious secret ingredient and folks do make their own version of that. It's 1:50. We talk about Donald Trump in the 2 o'clock hour on this show. Today, the focus is on the health care legislation. And where is that going? 9 minutes to the news and more chatter about that after on WGN.
If we waited 2 years, it's going to explode. Nobody's going to be able to afford it. It's a disaster. We want to get something done and get it done right.
That's the plan. The question is today, are they getting it done? It's 2:08 on WGN. John Williams in the Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. So here's what CNN has posted, too. In addition to the news you just heard here on WGN Radio, the Republican health care legislation remains in limbo this afternoon. Multiple meetings between members of Congress and the White House. It's unclear if they're even going to get a vote today. The conservative House Freedom Caucus, whose members appear to hold the key, I'm reading from CNN, met with President Trump earlier today. The session started with a standing ovation for the president. Nice! And then little obvious progress they could point to afterwards. One person that was in the meeting said it was, quote-unquote, intense. The Freedom Caucus has been delivered a final offer, said a member of the House leadership. The caucus has been delivered a final offer. So to these naysayers so far, these very conservative members of the Republican Party who want it to be a little harsher, if you will, a little more restrictive, they've been given the final offer from House leadership. According to Patrick McHenry, he is the chief deputy whip. He said it's really in the hands of the members there to accept or reject the offer. And if these people don't sign on, then it doesn't pass. It doesn't mean it's the end of the thing, but it means that it's stuck on its first vote today. If they voted today, it's not clear that they will. Okay, so let's talk again to our friend who's the expert on all of this. Mary Agnes Carey is with Kaiser Health Group Partnerships. She's the editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And she joins us again on WGN. Thanks for joining us, Mary Agnes. How are you?
Doing great. Doing fine.
You know anything more than what I now know, having just heard me read all of that?
No. There's going to be a press conference, a news conference with Speaker Paul Ryan at 3:30. We're kind of hoping then to get a little bit of more of an update, but it could be simply a status check where he says some of the things that you've just said, that it could be that negotiations are ongoing, they're trying to get this. We've heard Speaker Ryan and President Trump talk about how this is the time to make this happen. I'm sure that that is that message, that theme is being echoed, whether it's a meeting at the White House or a meeting on Capitol Hill. So we'll hope to get a status report at 3:30 where things stand, but I think it's going to be a long night.
3:30 Eastern time?
Correct, 3:30 Eastern time, yes.
Okay, so in about 19 minutes here, it's just now 2:11 in Chicago. I wonder if, though, they placate this, you know, vestige of the Tea Party group, if they make the cuts or the restrictions that they want there, will they then lose moderates on the other end?
That's exactly the formula, the problem that they're facing, because if they take the bill further to the right, if they make it more conservative, they do lose some of the moderates, and this is a balancing act because you've got to hit that magic number. It's about 215 votes in the House. And that's exactly what they have to balance. If they the Freedom Caucus has about, I think, 40 members. The Tuesday group, which is the moderates, also has a significant block of votes. And it's that balancing. You got to think of it as kind of a big balloon. You squeeze one end, something pops at the other.
Yeah,
it's just that way.
Is there something about the bill per se an issue? Is it the block grants to states? Is it that men have to pay for women's health care? Is there an issue or two that is particularly thorny for them?
There has been a discussion amongst the Freedom Caucus, and again, this is the more conservative caucus, that they don't like this element of the bill called the essential health benefits, which is part of exactly what you talked about. It's 10 categories of coverage. They include, you know, they include maternity care, pediatric care, hospitalization, emergency room services. And there has been some concern that this array of benefits is too generous, is too costly, and that insurers should be able to pick and choose what they want to do. But the problem is that is set in statute. And the rules that govern the House and the rules that govern the Senate are different. But suffice it to say that even if the House passed legislation that stripped the essential health benefits, there is no guarantee, because of the Senate rules, that that would be allowed to occur in the Senate. So it's kind of an inside ball game, but it's the thought is that if you want to get a package on the House floor that could be approved by the House floor to make it as easy as possible to run the Senate procedural hurdles. There's a name for it, reconciliation. We're all hearing about it now. It allows the bill to pass with just 51 votes in the Senate. And as we know, Republicans only have 52 votes in that chamber, and you've got about a dozen Republicans that are concerned about various elements of the package in the Senate. So to create another obstacle may not be the way that House Republican leaders want to go. So that's one of the key elements they're talking about it now. Sean Spicer, the White House spokesman, was talking about it at the briefing, that there's some examination of this, but I'm not quite sure where that's going to end.
So if the House says, okay, we'll strip out these 10 health benefits that are currently in Obamacare, maybe that'll placate the House, but that might not fly in the Senate. Now you've got sort of a twisted version of the bill, and maybe that's not the best one. In fact, that's interesting, isn't it, that this conversation is about the politics, not the merit of health care and a health care bill.
Well, one would argue, could argue rather, that the essential health benefits are absolutely about the merits of the health care law, and it is a very key policy issue, because if you make all plans offer an array of services, that can make it more attractive to healthy people who you want to enroll, for example, to help balance the cost, balance the risk pool, as they call it.
Right.
But the other thing to remember here is no matter really what the House passes, it's going to be changed at the Senate. That seems to be very clear. You have moderate senators that do not like prohibitions on funding for Planned Parenthood, for example. You have moderate Republicans in the Senate that do not like the changes in the Medicaid funding, which, again, takes it from an uncapped entitlement to a limited amount of money. There are some other areas of dispute, but one mantra, if you will, of the House Republican leadership has been to the caucus, look, folks, it's going to get changed anyway in the Senate. Let's just get it over there and keep the process going. But obviously, with the concerns here in the House between the moderates and the conservatives. They're not necessarily buying that argument.
Well, I understand your point that they need to make it as attractive as possible. That's the politics and the merit at the same time. That is, if you strip out too many of the features, then people won't sign up for it. And without the mandate, why would you sign up for something that doesn't help you? So people might just choose to not take any insurance, health insurance coverage.
Right. Yeah, they could do it. Now, if they do that, under the plan as it now exists, they get hit with a 30% surcharge for a year after they sign up, that they have no coverage for about a 63-day period. So there are arguments, analysts that argue perhaps that's not severe enough, but there is something in the plan, right, to try to stop that.
I think that's I just think that's the most interesting psychology experiment or sociology experiment built into this, and people don't talk about it much. But if you opt out, fine. But when you come back in, fella, we're going to charge you a 30% penalty. And I think the person who opts out doesn't think like that. They don't care. And you say, okay, let's make it more severe. We'll say that the premium will be double if you opt out and you try and get back in. That's the same person. He still doesn't care. He's young or he's poor or he's stupid or he's angry, but he doesn't care. I don't know that the number can get high enough. That's just my own sociological view on this, Mary.
You have to remember, too, that some people don't look at health insurance as an essential cost in their budgets. They're more worried, obviously, about their rent.
Yeah, sure.
Payment, that kind of thing. And so they look at it as something they'll get around to. But, of course, if they got into some sort of medical issue and didn't have insurance, then they could be on the hook for a lot of costs. So that's the other thing to think about.
I wanted to just talk about some of those 10 essential health benefits that the Obama people love, and maybe you like it if you're using these services, but some people don't for a variety of reasons. Some of it is ideological, like, oh, against my religious views or something like that. And then some of it is just something you don't want to pay for. Maternity care is on there. So is that an issue in that some men don't feel like they should have to pay for services that women would use but men would not? And is that then a problem for a congressman?
Well, that is certainly one of the arguments, right? If you were a single man, you may not want to pay for maternity coverage, but I would argue the women covered by maternity coverage might not want to pay for your knee surgery when you blow it out in a weekend game on the ball field. I mean, the way this works is insurance is the balancing of risk.
Or Viagra.
Well, there you go. Another example. So you could certainly pick and choose that. But again, the idea, and this is not everyone agrees on this, but the premise behind these in the Affordable Care Act is they being the proponents of the legislation, the writers of the bill, the analysts looked at the individual market as it existed before 2010 when this became law, the ACA, Affordable Care Act became law, and said there were a lot of discrepancies in many of these policies. Perhaps they should be more balanced. And again, there were lots of folks who had health insurance that they liked, and perhaps they couldn't afford this more comprehensive coverage, or they didn't want the more comprehensive coverage. But nonetheless, this is kind of the baseline of the Affordable Care Act, and it is a key argument now whether or not that they should remain.
Well, I wonder with this plan, would the premiums go down for people? I mean, I know not for all, maybe some up, some
right.
down, but I mean, is it arguable that this really would be a much better bill for a lot of people?
Well, that remains unclear. Let me try to unpack this a little bit.
Hold on. Unpack it in 1 minute. And by the way, you may have a question or comment for our guest, too. Kaiser Health Group Partnership Editor and Senior Correspondent Mary Agnes. Carrie's on the line. These are the people that nonpartisan look at healthcare issues. They're the ones to go to. And she's been very good with her time with us. If you've got a question or comment, now's the time to call. Kaiser Health News, Mary Agnes. Carrie, thank you for joining us. But you have a few things to say about that. We'll still take a couple of calls, and then I'll give my answers, and I don't know what I'm talking about. We'll start with Rhonda. You're on the air. Hi, Rhonda. You're on WGN. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm doing real well. I did want to give a call because I followed you for years, so welcome back.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say with all that's going on, I like to go by Rhonda for the simple fact that I do lean towards the right. I am an extremely conservative person, and I was telling your screener, the Obamacare plan was a train wreck. And it's not because the intent wasn't good. his intent was incredible. And we are in a position now that even being a conservative, you certainly don't want to pull the rug out from under everybody.
Right, right.
By the same token, just to give you a quick answer, because I'm going back to you, had published a letter from a man in Frankfurt, and I think he presented our position really well. But you, in your eloquent way, were able to turn it around. But he is a person like me. I'm not pounding the pavement. I am not out on the streets. I'm not screaming. I'm not yelling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a person that can have a dialogue to discuss things. And that's where a lot of the problems are nowadays, that we're not discussing things anymore. But to say specifically what's going on here, it is the first time that I have sent off emails and that. Even though I voted for him here, as the fellow in Frankfurt did.
Wait a minute. What's in your emails? What are you sending out?
No. Well, basically, as soon as I read what the GOP plan was going to do,
yeah,
I was totally against it. And the fact that Paul Ryan, with a straight face, could support it, I said, you have to put it in perspective quickly. I believe in a mandate that, obviously, if you were going to have a kumbaya moment and say everybody is entitled to health care, then I'm sorry, there has to be a mandate that we all pay into it. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
So I thought, until December. Well, there is an insurance company out there that starts with a B, ends with a D, and it's four words. And nobody seems to discuss this company. But they're everywhere, and they have become the monopoly.
Okay, hold on a second, Rhonda, because I don't have much more time. But, I mean, you don't like the plan. You have problems with it. But you do think there should be a mandate, right?
I do. I did until December when I got my new payment plan, and I, being a 60-year-old woman, was going to be charged $500 more for my plan. And quickly, John, I just found out a week ago, and a dear friend who I love is thrilled with Obamacare. She pays $40 a month.
Yeah.
And I love her dearly, which is why I don't want to give names.
Well, I don't, and you can't blame her for loving it if that's all it's going to cost her. You know, the thing that you can't know is if you didn't have Obamacare, or say for the last 7 years, by the way, today is the signing anniversary. This is when Vice President Joe Biden leaned into Barack Obama and said, this is a big bleeping deal. It was the Bidenist moment we've ever had. This is the 7-year anniversary of it. What we can't know is if at that time Barack Obama had signed the health care plan that the Republicans want now or didn't sign anything at all, we can't know what would have happened to your premiums today. It's possible they would still be high. It's possible they would be higher. It's possible they'd be lower. You can't, you know, as Dick Cheney said, know the unknown. And so I've heard other experts say that premiums go up and health care is leading the charge. And that's just the way it is. That's the way it's going to be. Maybe you can blame this on Obamacare, but you can't blame all of this on Obamacare. It's 2:28. I appreciate your call, Rhonda. I don't suppose you've had a chance to read that Time magazine article yet, huh?
Which Time magazine article?
So it's I'm not sure.
the one.
The cover story in the latest issue, the one that's titled Is Truth Dead? And then they have an interview with Donald Trump. I haven't read the article. I haven't read the whole issue. I will. At least I'll read this interview because everybody is talking about it today. It's one of the big trending things. It's just a sit-down interview that Time magazine recorded, and they talked to the president. And then they just sort of printed the question and the answer verbatim, evidently, as the president spoke. He has a unique style. And when you read it in print like that, it's kind of bizarre. And people are just flipping out there today about this Q&A with the sitting president and some of the things that he said. Outlandish is Donald Trump's trademark, but people are more characterizing this as just not all that coherent.
Usually we speak in subject, verb, object.
He does not.
A lot of dot, dot, dot. A lot of continuing sentences.
A lot of sort of tangents, and we're all subject to that. Lord knows I do it on this show enough, and I beg your patience when I do. So I think the president should be afforded that. But I also think the president should be as circumspect as he can, as deliberate as he can, as careful as he can. He wasn't careful. He was just going on. He said, I'm the president and you're not. Bada bing. He said that except for the bada bing part. So the other interesting thing about this, and I'll just have to read it, and you can too. Steve Cochran read from it on the air this morning and every now and then would pause and say, remember, I'm not making this up. I haven't read it yet. But I did look up the title, because the title of the, you know, the cover story on the cover is Truth Dead? Now, you may say that about mainstream media. That may be true about politicians. Obviously, Sean Spicer, Kellyanne Conway, and Donald Trump have sort of challenged our notion of truth these days anyway. So that's, I think, a reasonable topic that's out there. They did it in the same font and style as the April 1966 issue, Is God Dead? When they did the Is God Dead article, cover story, Time Magazine, 1966, it was about how society is becoming less and less tied to religious tenets, you know, or sort of becoming more secular. The world was changing. Don Draper didn't go to church all of the time. So they wrote this, Is God Dead? They drew some conclusions. They had interesting articles. People took so much exception to the title and the cover and the stories. They got 3,500 letters complaining about it. Never before has Time Magazine received so many angry letters as they did when they did the Is God Dead issue. I wonder if they're going to get a lot of heat for Is Truth Dead? Because you may see that as a commentary on the president. You don't like that. I may see that as a commentary on the media, and I don't like that. I think it's a fair question, don't you think? That is a reasonable question right now.
I bet you that they've gotten more than 3,000 tweets about that so far.
Yeah, nobody writes letters anymore, and they hardly even email. But I'll bet that the some way of measuring the reaction for Time Magazine, this will be very high for them. I don't suppose they get as many reactions as often as they will to this one. I'll tell you just one other thing that's percolating in the news today about Team Trump, and that is his son Donald Jr. sent out a tweet that he probably wishes he could bring back. After the terrorist attack in London yesterday, even as they were still picking up the bodies, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted, "You have got to be kidding me. Terror attacks are part of living in a big city," says London Mayor Sadiq Khan. So Donald Trump Jr. tweets out, "You have to be kidding me. Terror attacks are part of living in big city," says London Mayor Sadiq Khan. And that makes it sound like, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about this. They're not going to be tough on terrorism. They're just accepting that this is what has to happen. So Donald Trump Jr. said, "You've got to be kidding me." I'm reading now from MSN.com. Mr. Khan said in an issue last September, in an interview with The Independent, it's a British newspaper. The British newspaper last September interviews the mayor of London. And in there, he said that terrorism preparedness, including providing sufficient support to the police, was, quote, part and parcel of living in a global city. That's the sort of quote that Donald Trump Jr. appropriated. He said, "Terrorism preparedness, including providing sufficient support to the police, was part and parcel of living in a great global city. That means being vigilant, having a police force that is in touch with communities. It means the security services being ready. It also means exchanging ideas and best practices," he also said to the Evening Standard in a video that was published there. "Nothing is more important to me," he said, "than keeping Londoners safe. I wanted to be reassured that every single agency and individual involved in protecting our city has the resources and expertise they need to respond in the event that London is attacked." Ciaran Jenkins, a correspondent for Britain's Channel 4, asked Mr. Trump on Twitter, the Sun, "Did you even read the article before goading London's mayor during a live incident?" Trump Jr. tweeted, "You've got to be kidding me. Terror attacks are part of living in big city," says London Mayor Sadiq Khan. Put that over there for now. Press conference still delayed from Paul Ryan. We'll see what happens on healthcare and keep you posted. The front page story today in the Chicago Sun-Times I thought was pretty funny. And if you go to page 6, the fuller details are there. Andrew Peterson, I don't know if you're out there or listening, but I want to talk to you, man, because I think this guy is really interesting. Andrew Peterson is the ticket writer who is like the greatest parking ticket writer in the history of parking tickets. He brags on social media that he's generating a lot of money for the city. This one guy in parking tickets in 2016 generated almost $2 million in parking tickets. And so people started to complain because he'd hit up some wards really hard, and then they'd complain to the alder people. And the alderman would say, hey, what is your guy terrorizing? Boy, there's a poor choice of words. Harassing our residents in my ward. So now they've assigned him to a different part of the city. They didn't say they fired him, but they said that the guy was doing his job so well that maybe he should do it well someplace else right now. The city says it wasn't a retaliation for him writing up a lot of parking tickets to people that were illegally parking, but that they tend to rotate people throughout the community. So his time was up. What a coincidence. Peterson, whose city salary is $47,000 a year, bragged about his ticket writing skills in a series of Facebook posts. He made $824 in overtime last year, 774 tickets issued by computer, about 20 handwritten tickets, called the first 5 days of work for the month, 794, he wrote. He said, I've written more tickets in 5 days than some people in my department write in a month. 744 tickets equals $62,905 in generated revenue for the city budget. I think he thinks he's doing us all good. In an October Facebook post, Peterson bragged, I wrote 203 tickets from 8:40 a.m. to 2:40 p.m. That's 33.33 tickets per hour. If you write 33 tickets in an hour, if you write 30 tickets in an hour, that's one every 2 minutes, right? So you're just going up to a car, parking ticket, park, and you do that all day long. And I don't know if he thinks he's sort of a champion for the city or if he just likes ruining people's days. The complaints about Peterson's tactics were first reported in DNA Info, Chicago. And the Sun-Times used some of their reporting, I guess, in their story. He posted this in February. Chicago, you have been warned. I'm working Sunday. Do not park illegally when you go to worship your God of choice. This is Andrew Peterson. Andrew, if you're listening, 312-981-7200, I'm trying to find you, and I just want to know what makes you tick. Let's talk to Bonnie. You're on WGN. Hi, Bonnie. It's John. What can I do for you?
Hey, John, I was just listening to you're talking about that ticket maniac, and I'm wondering if I wasn't a victim of his zeal. I don't live in Chicago, but I visit there once in a while, and the last time I was down there, I parked in a legal parking area, albeit it was tight, you know what I mean? And the next day when I went out to get my car, it had been towed.
I don't know what... Wait, but go back. You said I parked in a legal parking area. It was tight, if you know what I mean. Was there a meter?
Yeah, no. It was the cars. There were a lot of cars. So
I see.
But I got, you know, I got my car in there.
But you didn't need a permit to park on that street. Yeah,
no.
Okay.
No, sir.
Are you?
And
sure
I went back to get the car, and of course it was gone. And in talking to a collection company about another issue I have, they said, hey, you got two parking tickets from the city of Chicago for $100.50 each. And I'm like, what? I never got a ticket. Never got a ticket on my car. I would think when they towed the car, the ticket would have been there. And they claimed it was parked where I didn't park it. And that's the thing that really concerns me. How did it get around the corner from where I left it?
Yeah. This happens when I lived in Peoria, people would sometimes get tickets mailed to them or notified that they had a ticket, and they hadn't been in Chicago in years. And I don't remember how, and then I don't know what recourse you have here. I think your best bet is to just send the money.
Yeah, but that makes me want to throw up, you know, because I think there's something going on here. And talking to one of my daughters, she years back, she got a bill for $50,000 for blowing toll booths, and which was absurd.
Yeah, but a lot of people were earning those. She wasn't, though? She wasn't blowing the toll booths?
No. And so she got a hold of the Sun-Times. Sun-Times put her on front page, and things changed with her $50,000 ticket.
You know, I'm teasing you about the best recourse is to send the money in, but I don't know what options you have. Like, if you go... And how much fun is this? Take a day off of work or come back into the city and then, I don't know where you go, the courthouse or whatever, or the city office.
I don't either.
And you say, all right, I wasn't. They go, you have no piece of paper. I guess you don't have the ticket that you didn't get.
No.
Well, then did they send you a notice in the mail that you?
No, I heard it. I have.
It was from the collection agency. So I guess somebody could click, look it up. Maybe you shouldn't ask. Maybe you shouldn't ask.
They weren't looking. The collection company was not looking for these bills. It was a different one from a couple of years ago I thought I had taken care of through the city. And he told me that, hey, you got two tickets sitting out there. And I'm like, well, where's the tickets? I don't have a paper ticket, you know?
Yeah. So literally, you weren't there. You then have been told that you have a parking ticket on your record there and you owe the city $150.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep listening, Bonnie. Somebody's going to tell you what to do.
Okay. Thanks, John. Good to hear you again.
And it's nice to hear you. I'm sorry under these circumstances. I don't have any information for you, or I don't have a battle plan for you. Plus, I'm kind of curious what you think about this guy. Still haven't heard from Andrew Peterson. Andrew, the super zealous parking ticket writer. Is he doing a good thing there by doing his job well, or is he doing a bad thing by doing his job that well? Margaret, this is John. You're on the air. What can I do for you, or you for me?
They talk about people leaving Chicago, 20,000 some people this past year and so on. People can't, the average person who just is a hardworking person can't afford to live in the city anymore because you can't afford to go anyplace. You can't park your car, and I'm talking about legally. You can't afford to park anyplace. You have to rush to run into a store because you don't want to get a ticket.
Yeah.
So people get fed up with that, and they figure, you know what? I can't afford to live this way. I don't like the pressure, along with the other political problems we have. And they just leave, whether they leave to the suburbs or they just leave Illinois completely. So when they're talking about why is the number of people going down in Chicago, that's just one of many reasons. I don't do anything in Chicago anymore. I was born and raised in Chicago. I just got so fed up the last few years. I moved to a neighboring suburb, and I have never been happier in my life.
You know, that's, I'm sorry to hear that, but I totally get it. And I think you make a really good point. If we had ample parking and people were just being lazy, write them a ticket. But it's so hard to find a place to park. I know you have to write tickets on occasion, but I don't think they need to be that aggressive about it because we're not all bad people. There's just no place to park sometimes.
And there should be affordable, you know.
And the tickets should be reasonable. Parking. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the phone call. No, I'm glad you joined us on that. Really, I agree. And too often those tickets are written to people who have less money. And it's disproportionately hard for them. Tom, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi.
Well, mine was more of a nightmare experience. I came home from California, and I realized, supposedly my transgression against the city were two parking tickets from 1991. Now we're talking about 2016. I came home. I had parked outside at the remote parking at O'Hare, and my car had been booted. And it was, this was back in January. And when I called the number on the sticker on my window, they had told me that, I had an outstanding balance of over $1,100.
Jeez.
For two tickets from 1991 that I had no recollection of. As a matter of fact, I was in the military through 1991. So part of that time I was in Connecticut. So, and the city, and there was nothing, absolutely nothing I could do other than they were going to keep the car.
I'm surprised. Oh, really? Because, that's what got you down this road. I'm surprised that it didn't compound beyond $1,100. I thought you were going to say $11,000.
No. Well, I was pretty pissed that it was
$1,100. No, I'm not saying that's good, but it could have been worse.
Well, no, and the other thing I learned that some people may not realize is these red light cameras and everything that's going on, if you don't pay them, if you just say forget it with the city of Chicago or any of the suburbs, the state controller's office now will take any, if you have a state refund, and take that money directly out of your state refund.
Really?
And apply it directly to those municipalities.
How efficient
is that? If you think you're actually going to get away with it, you won't, and I found that out the hard way.
Thank you for your service, sir. I'm sorry that we did that to you.
Yeah. Well, you did it. The city did. So
yeah,
I understand why people are leaving. But all right, but
thanks for the call, Tom. Yeah, have a good afternoon. By the way, Christine, I don't have time for your call, but Christine says she went to court and she won. But the city still took my money. Okay, well, now I don't know what all of that means. Christine, I don't have time. Let's take Christine's name and number. We'll call her back tomorrow at this time and finish that conversation. This conversation And that story, I just saw Roe and Anna DeVlantis walk across Michigan Avenue. They had coffees, and they looked ready to talk. We'll visit with them next on WGN. Who are you, sir?
I'm Roe Khan. I used to be somebody in this town, but I am here now.
You look good. You look better than you probably did.
Yeah. It was a rough couple of days, John. I'm not going to lie to you. But I was able to stay on the air. I just was able to do the show from our basement, which is, you know, worked out very well.
Convenient enough.
Very convenient enough. I'm capable of doing that. Now I'm back here in the studio here at Tribune Tower. I'm feeling much better than I was a couple of days ago. So we're good.
It's good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you. That's what you think.
That's right.
Now, coming up, well, there's been, just in the last 20 minutes, a lot of commotion in Washington. The House has postponed the vote tonight for the health care repeal and replace. The White House has just now released a statement saying, well, then it's rescheduled for tomorrow morning now, isn't it? Because they didn't want to do it in the middle of the night.
Well, I think the reason they didn't want to do it in the middle of the night is because they didn't have the votes. Does Trump think that they're going to get the votes overnight?
That's what he seems to think there's going to be now.
Does he understand why they're not voting tonight?
He does, but I think what they want to do is this is, I think, you know, pretty standard now in Washington. You see this, is that there's a convenient excuse for everything. No thought goes unchallenged at this moment without, you know, a guiding and gliding kind of excuse for what happened. So he does. I think that they think that tonight there's going to be some open debate about this. And during the debate, they're going to get something done. So we'll see. I got to just sit back there and see. And then, by the way, the details of whatever the president or whatever the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes found yesterday are going to be given to Democrats tomorrow, which means going to be released. Because don't you think Democrats are very quickly going to be releasing things that...
There'll be a lot of talk about
there'll be some leakage,
sure.
Is my guess, like sieve-like things that happen. So stay tuned for Friday. Stay tuned for today. We got a lot coming up.
Have a good show.
Thank you very much, John.